Welcome to the ANews podcast. This is episode 94. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the non-sectarian anarchistnews.org.
A short editorial. Envy! I, and I imagine many other people, have always envied the talented. Whether you're good at painting, coding, cooking, music, whatever, I'm mad at you because I want to be good at those things too, damn it. But why am I envious? Moving past platitudes like a desire to express myself, man, or self-actualization, I found that a lot of my envy is currently driven by capital and the ways it constrains my desire. I don't necessarily envy the talented artists because they're living a more authentic life, since what does that even mean? But because their set of skills, in my mind, allows them in some ways to fit more comfortably into capitalism. I imagine that knowing you have a skill makes your slog through capital, if indeed you have one, slightly more clear, whereas the talentless such as myself are left to constantly bang around from one failed possibility to another. This dilemma, although obviously living in my head, is also an obvious creation of the work machine. I see talent as a means to monetary ends most of the time, rather than something to be shared with others, free of charge. Trying to push this dilemma slightly further, I've attempted to imagine how my envy would work in something like a post-collapse, or at least sandbookish near future. Would I still envy the artist if my daily struggle wasn't just getting my ass to work, but instead finding food and water? Would I still dream of mastering a skill like music if my existence was no longer the almost entirely individuated affair that city life and rent paying make it? I imagine probably not, as the next phase of capital, society, whatever, would probably not be the beginning of unbound desire, but the further leveling of most people to the same level of useful uselessness. Hooray!
This week, the trial of Dr. Bones from philobarbarous.wordpress.com by Lethlin, a site that consists of only this post. This is a satire about Dr. Bones, which is close to redundant, honestly, but okay. For someone who thinks that Dr. Bones is a worthy adversary or worthy anything, icon of a generation, maybe? Here is some snark. Quote, I accuse Dr. Bones of a childish respect for images, constantly oscillating between enthusiasm and disappointment, lacking in taste because he has had no happy or meaningful experience of anything, and refusing to admit his unhappy experiences because he lacks courage as well as taste, which is why Dr. Bones never ceases to be taken in by every sort of fraud, general or particular, that appeals to his self-alienated credulity, unquote. My take is that Dr. Bones is not worth this much attention, and really, this list of accusations is too long. It cannot fail to be repetitive. But it does sound like someone had fun.
The Shape of Anarchist History from the Libertarian Labyrinth by our friend Sean P. Wilbur, another of the tired and frustrated old-timers who continue to find anarchy a worthwhile provocation, even while the world tries to kick it out of us. I consider Wilbur a historian's historian. Delighted by arcane details and alternate readings of esoterica. In other words, an example to us all. Quote, Blanchard is in some ways the ideal material on which to test my developing understanding of anarchist history. He poses all sorts of difficulties when approached directly. We can ask, was Calvin Blanchard an anarchist? But none of the various answers that present themselves are entirely satisfactory, in large part because the question seems forced. Almost no one, present company excluded, cares whether Calvin Blanchard belonged to this or that political or philosophical tendency. Blanchard barely matters now, even as an amusing footnote in the various histories he crossed, and making him matter seems likely to be hard and perhaps useless work. He's not Eliphalet Kimball, another unknown, but at least one who made his own case at the time for inclusion in a history of anarchy and its promoters, provided someone finally came along and discovered him. He's not Lysander Spooner, whose place in anarchist history has provoked lively debate, even if the stakes have never been entirely clear. He's certainly not Josiah Warren, who, despite repudiating most labels, was embraced much more widely and had his work incorporated to a much more significant degree, an occurrence that it would now be hard to entirely jettison or excommunicate.
His importance, if indeed he has some real importance in the story, is as an outlier among the outliers. Ask a similar question about the other figures just named, and perhaps that doubly marginal character makes him a particularly interesting topic, but only if your search for answers takes you in directions that also make you a bit of an outlier in the discussions of anarchist history, unquote. We love us some outliers, dammit. Wilbur also makes, by hand, beautiful little books, for those of you who like that sort of thing.
On the passing of anarchist comrade Demetris Armakulis, from It's Going Down, a eulogy for someone lethally hurt by a power line while hanging a solidarity banner for Marios Sesidi, 11-year fugitive now facing 36 years in prison for bank robbery in Athens. The eulogy for Armakulis is glowing, tracing their changes from a liberal to an expat to a repat, member of the Kalkaki squat, good friend to his dog companion, etc. Quote, Demetris was a kid of the metropolis. Growing up in Athens, he became interested in movements at a very young age, unfortunately being swept up at first by the deceptions of liberal groups such as the now in power Syriza. He was motivated by a strong desire to practice mutual aid, direct action, and other anarchist principles, inevitably leading to a sudden and intense disillusionment with Syriza and all its garbage politics. His disillusionment with Syriza not only led to his abandonment of liberal politics, but a complete rejection for all political parties and hierarchical organizations. His disillusionment was accompanied by a frustration and sadness, feeling taken advantage of by a political group in his youth for what he thought were the personal interests of grassroots politicians looking to advance their privileges and social capital in accordance with the existing institutions of this vile society and the general state apparatus that Syriza has always cooperated with at its core, unquote.
The yellow vests show how much the ground moves under our feet. From infoshop.org by Graeber, originally in French, in Le Monde. This is an interesting read addressing myth-making, i.e., who is in a position to quote-unquote universalize, and the way that identity politics plays or is played in today's political conflicts. Quote, working people in this new centrist reality are increasingly denied any possibility of universalism, since they literally cannot afford it. The ability to act out of concern for the planet, for instance, rather than the exigencies of sheer survival, is now a direct side effect of forms of money creation and managerial distribution of rents. Anyone who is forced to think only of their own or their family's immediate material needs is seen as asserting a particular identity. And while certain identities might be condescendingly indulged, that of the white working class can only be a form of racism. One saw the same thing in the U.S., where liberal commentators managed to argue that if Appalachian coal miners voted for Bernie Sanders, a Jewish socialist, it must nonetheless somehow be an expression of racism, as with the strange insistence that the Gilles Jaunes must be fascists, even if they haven't realized it. Unquote. Lacking specific information about France, I would not take Graeber's analysis of that situation without salt, but his perspective, as tangentially self-aggrandizing as it might be, one doesn't need to bring up Occupy or the title of your latest book quite so often, really, has some value as it points out that we're in a transitional stage and previous assumptions must be tossed. Quote, one way you know that a moment of global revolution has indeed taken place is that ideas considered madness a very short time before have suddenly become the ground assumptions of political life. The leaderless, horizontal, directly democratic structure of Occupy, for instance, was almost universally caricatured as idiotic, starry-eyed, and impractical, and as soon as the movement was suppressed, pronounced the reason for its failure. Certainly it seemed exotic, drawing heavily not only on the anarchist tradition, but on radical feminism and even certain forms of indigenous spirituality. But it has now become clear that it has become the default mode for democratic organizing everywhere, from Bosnia to Chile to Hong Kong to Kurdistan. If a mass democratic movement does emerge, this is the form it can now be expected to take. In France, Nuit Debout might have been the first to embrace such horizontalist politics on a mass scale, but the fact that a movement originally of rural and small-town workers and the self-employed has spontaneously adopted a variation on this model shows just how much we are dealing with a new common sense about the very nature of democracy. Unquote. I, for one, would argue that calling it democracy is constraining our imaginations and the change that has happened in exactly the ways he says not to. But whatever. Regardless, this is not the article to read if you're trying to find out what is up in France.
Anarchists publish info of hundreds of French police. from cybergorilla.org/blog, a site that seems to take itself seriously regarding anonymity and security, but also has a weird and confusing butthurt page. The circle A is one of the many symbols flashed, while the main one is from System Shock, the video game. So take that how you will. This is just a brief announcement. The headline gives the most information. Quote, "The logic of the state and capital of punishment and imprisonment must be replaced by a rejection of oppression and exploitation. This call is one step in that direction. We come together to break the loneliness and isolation. Offensive solidarity with the comrades who face repression in France and other regions in the earth. The memory of our comrades is fuel to stoke the flames of our lives in permanent revolt." Signed, Anonymous Anarchist Agency. Unquote.
Anarchism at the End of the World from ExpressiveEgg.org, a blog about unconditional love, death, origins of civilization, horrors of work, etc. This is a lengthy and aggressive defense of anarchism. It includes some sound points, many things that most anarchists take for granted, which doesn't, of course, necessarily make them valid, and a distracting number of confusing assertions, which do have the benefit of being controversial, if nothing else. For example, the author includes the ego as one of the quote-unquote dominants, i.e. one of the seven things that anarchists reject. This is because, quote, "it is indisputable that their restless mind and emotions take control of conscious experience and cause men and women to do, say, think, and feel things they don't really want to, cause them to hate, for example, get angry, and depressed, or worry. I may want to stop wanting and worrying, but if I'm honest, I can see that I am not in charge here. My stupid self is." Unquote. There is a significant philosophical and or psychological assumption there, which is that we are separate from our stupid selves, but that premise is never explained. Elsewhere, the stupid self is called the false self, which obviously doesn't clarify anything at all, except that the author feels free to determine that there are false selves responsible for the unpleasant feelings that we have. Presumably, once we are fully actualized, anarchists will only be calm, happy, etc. all the time. And, of course, the author knows which self is false and which isn't. I would give this paper a B for commitment, I guess.
Arming Negativity Toward the Queerest Attack, from Anonymous. This is a response to the article on A-News last week, Beyond Negativity, What Comes After Gender Nihilism. This is more confusing than it needs to be due to all the anonymity that is going on. First, there was the article, Gender Nihilism. Then the same Anon who wrote Gender Nihilism, I believe, wrote Beyond Negativity on changing their mind from some of the things they had said in the original article. Then this current Anon, Arming Negativity Anon, writes this response to both of those articles. I guess, I think that's right. Okay, so the point of this piece seems mainly to be refuting the leftist communist presumptions in the Beyond Negativity article, and to reaffirm the more fuck-it-all attitude of the original piece, and to say that that attitude is best expressed through individual and subjective choices. Quote, "From my own individualist perspective, nihilism is so much more than just pessimism, negation, and violence. It is the personification of anarchy, the reclaiming of individuality, and the embracing of ungovernable uniqueness. Queer negativity is hostility towards socially constructed expectations, those who enforce them, and is subsequently the emancipation of one's undefinable self from gender conformity. This includes the expropriation of violence and the total abandonment of victimhood. Queer nihilism materializes itself as a declaration of war on society. For every possibility of sexual assault, there is a blade being sharpened for self-defense. Dangerous spaces are personified, replacing the positive politics of safety. Armed queers don't just make waves, they are tsunamis against the logic of submission." Unquote. Nice. I would only add, Oxford commas, people, they're good.
Response to William Gillis regarding Diagnostic of the Future, from Anonymous, by Peter Gelderloos. Okay, see, here's a series of named authors. Makes it much clearer what is going on. Gelderloos wrote a thing, Diagnostic of the Future. Gillis responded, Gelderloos smacks back. I can see why Gillis has an excitement for Gelderloos, as the latter is one of the few patient enough to respond thoughtfully to Gillis' bad reading slash writing. Quote, "Actually, my article is quite different from the one that William is responding to, even as they go on rather long rants about abstractions that, ironically, are wholly lacking in substance, detail, and particularity. Their thoughts on fascism hinge on a misreading of my own critique when they say I claim that fascism should only be critiqued at the institutional level and never at the ideological level. This is false. What I actually say is that fascist ideology is less important in the historical moment when fascists have little or no elite support than it is in the moment when capitalists and militarists have decided to throw their weight behind it. This is a difficult argument to dispute, which may be why William doesn't engage with it. They claim I only deal with fascism at the level of institutional abstractions, and not the level of specific people. Another falsehood. I talk about how specific capitalists have supported or not supported fascist movements and what this means. And even though I extensively critique how problematic it is that many contemporary anti-fascists do not define fascism as they increasingly toss it around as an alarmist label, William does the exact same thing. Unless we are to take the following minimal phrase seriously as a definition. Fascism is an ideology of hypernationalism and a might-makes-right fetishization of raw power. So, Winston Churchill was a fascist? Once again, this makes fascism a meaningless term, unquote. The paragraph on transhumanism is especially fun, but you can read it yourselves.
Call from the Yellow Vests of Commercy calling for popular assemblies. From Anonymous. A call for the Yellow Vests to reject the government's demand for representatives and for all the Yellow Vests to organize themselves. Quote, here in Commercy in the Meuse, we have been operating from the beginning with daily popular assemblies where each person participates equally. We organize to block entrances to the city and service stations and filtering roadblocks. In the process, we built a cabin in the central square. We meet there every day to organize ourselves, decide next actions, interact with people, and welcome those who join the movement. We also organize solidarity soups to live beautiful moments together and get to know each other. Inequality. But now the government and some parts of the movement propose to appoint representatives for each region. That is to say, a few people who would become the only interlocutors to public authorities and summarize our diversity. But we do not want representatives who would end up talking for us. What's the point? At Commercy, a punctual delegation met the sub-prefect in big cities. Others met directly with the prefect. They already have conveyed our anger and our demands. They already know we are determined to finish off with this hated president, this detestable government, and the rotten system they embody. Unquote. Best of luck to you.
Anathema, Volume 4, Issue 11 released. 12 pages. Cash bail is getting a lot of attention as a bad thing these days, and radicals have been working with liberals to end it. This issue of Anathema includes a piece on why ending cash bail only to rely more on judges is hardly a step in any anarchist direction. There's a piece on the security forces hired to deal with the survivors of the campfire camping in a Walmart parking lot. There's a climate change slash we're living in dystopia piece, for those who haven't been paying attention, that recommends non-participation, and one on splitting, inspired and opened by a poem by anarchist Dion De Prima, the most interesting essay in this issue, to me, and others on liberal, police, and fascist and security culture.
An Anarchist View of State Formation, review of Peter Gelderloos. Another badly titled review from Anarchismo by Wayne Price. Price is not reviewing Gelderloos, but only one of Gelderloos's books. This kind of sloppiness is distracting, although not as gross as the title of last week's review. At any rate, Price, as a staunch red anarchist, disagrees with Gelderloos on a variety of things. For example, Gelderloos is not a Marxist and explicitly rejects Marxist theory, re-state formation. Price also doesn't like that Gelderloos doesn't provide a definitive answer for how states formed. Quote, his book is a hodgepodge collection of accounts of state formations in no particular order, covering all sorts of possible causes in specific cases. This includes cultural and religious factors, as well as military, political, and geographic factors, among others. He ends up with no less than 15 models of state formation. That many factors go into the formation of each specific state is undoubtedly true. The question is whether any underlying generalizations can be made about the main factor or factors. Unquote. Classic. Obviously, I have my own biases, as I find Price's reasoning and writings stodgy, traditional, Marxist, and uninspired. We'll see if Peter finds it worthwhile to respond to this one as he did to Gillis's.
From Union Renewal to a Self-Managed Society, from Zabalaza by Lucian Vanderwalt. And people scoff that Anarchist News is non-sectarian. From Price to Vanderwalt, lucky us. This article is a miracle of unsubstantiated assertions. I will just put one here because, oh my god. Quote, people speak of a crisis of unionism, but we need to be careful about how we measure that. There is no proper database of unionism worldwide, but every indication is that unions overall remain quite stable in terms of numbers, and viewed globally, are even expanding. Unquote. Let me note, oh listener, that that last bit was italicized. Every indication? What indications? None are cited or referred to. I would really like to understand the reasoning behind anarcho-syndicalism, but I find only essays like this, in which the assumptions are rife and no facts are mentioned. Oh, here's another quote, because they just keep coming. Quote, unions persist precisely because capitalism and the state are simply unable to incorporate or co-opt the working class, unquote. Maybe it's drugs.
An Anarchist's Perspective on the Yellow Vests, from Anarchist Black Cross, Gothenburg, translated from the French. This kind of piece is hard because it seems like translation might be further confusing an attempt to discuss trends that are already contradictory. As far as I understand, this piece attempts to walk a line between full-throated support of the uprisings and anarchist purism. Quote, it is now obvious that, given the media exposure, the fierce repression, the fear and contempt it inspires to bourgeois, it would be ill-advised to ignore the Yellow Vest movement any longer. Especially since we talk about movement since the beginning of this article, it's good that we are in a dynamic, that things move, that the lines are moving. These people do not argue, do not want to sit around a table, they rise up. Unquote. The authors of this piece are certainly against political forces attempting to manage the uprising, but other than that, the translation makes it hard to know what is being attempted here. Maybe we'll get a better version of this in the future. It seems worth it to me.
Audio, Free Radical Radio Audiobooks, Desert by Anonymous, 3 hours, read by Dirt Roll. A gift for those of you who, perhaps, want to get depressed during your workout or commute, or perhaps will find yourself inspired by the gritty realism of this text. Or, perhaps, will be intrigued by the unusual sources of this anarchist book written years ago in the UK. The LBC version of this influential book, called in meme parlance the Sand Book versus Kropotkin's Bread Book, an iconic of new anarchists as the Kropotkin work is of classical anarchists, sports a quotation from Zerzan on the back. Zerzan really didn't like Desert. Some of us found that funny.
Anarchy Radio, December 11, 2018, an hour. Kathin co-hosts. Rhea calls in early on to talk about a book. Graeber doesn't describe the Gilets Jaunes very well. And calls in to rant about video games attached to gym equipment. Jay-Z really appreciates calls that only ask him to say, yeah.
FRR Books Podcast, The Unique and Its Property by Max Stirner, a close reading, part 5, 50 minutes. Five people continue the task of parsing what they can about Stirner's intentions and meanings as revealed in the great book. The write-up in this announcement is not bad, although it would be better with slightly fewer typos. It would also be nice if there were more than one way to bring the philosophy into our actual lives beyond the example of dating. Taoism comes up again. Might be nice if someone willing and able to speak as a Buddhist was part of these conversations?
Get to the moon. I'll wave those flags, wave those flags. To the man, my little island, little land.
Topic of the week: yellow, black, rectangular. Gilets Jaunes, the protest that we can't seem to stop talking about. To recap a few interesting events over the last week, more outrage was stoked when 140 high school students were forced to kneel and place their hands behind their heads while being arrested for protesting education reforms, inspiring high school students in Paris, Dijon, and other cities to reenact the scenario in solidarity. The protests seemed to be spreading to other countries as well, such as Brussels, where over 400 Yellow Vest-inspired protesters were arrested.
Which is not a country, but a city.
An anonymous anarchist group coordinated the collection and publication of the info of hundreds of French police officers. Many have even taken to calling it Yellow Vest Protests, hashtag Europe Spring. The purpose of this topic of the week is to attempt to bring together some of the perspectives that have already been shared, reflect on how they might have changed even in the few days since they've been written, and continue to advance our perspectives on what's happening. According to a brief note on the Yellow Vest movement presents something of a conundrum for anarchists. This is fair. Admittedly, it's a bit difficult to disentangle all of the party's fascists, workers, insurrectionists, as well as their agendas and the consequences of supporting them. The author continues, for fascists, the current reality represents an opportunity to sow a false narrative among the working class, blaming immigration, encouraging racism against minorities, and maligning environmentalism by associating with a state that is out of touch with the realities of everyday life. This makes me wonder, what sorts of opportunities does this represent for anarchists? What narrative might they sow? Or what new narratives might they create? Do anarchists have a narrative that could resonate more than what the fascists have to offer? Or even if it didn't resonate with the majority, could it be viable? And finally, there's a perspective put forth from a post by Attack, with a Q. The smashy smashy cannot replace anti-authoritarian ideas. We were in the streets back in 2016 and will be again, but not for the purpose of defending the world and its cars. Should we, as anarchists, carry on as usual, ignoring the weeks-long mobilization of multitudes because we only hit the streets or don't hit the streets for causes that suit us? What can we, as anarchists, learn from the Yellow Vest movement? Can we move into the future with fresh tactics, fresh vision, fresh narratives about the world we want to live in, without all of our efforts being in reaction to the right and to the state?
Boy, this is, I mean, whatever.
And we're off.
Well, I mean, I think on some level, it is extremely difficult for Americans to learn lessons that look like street protests from other parts of the world. And by and large, when we frame things in terms of like, you know, what are we learning or not learning from these other parts of the world, that's where we start to fuck up. Because we basically pretend like we have the same opportunities of political engagement and political power that these places, other places in the world do. The gap between the state apparatus sitting on top of us in the US and France is markedly different. And I'll just put it as simply as possible. France is the size of Texas. If we were talking about there being a vigorous, lively, a set of interlocutors in Texas, then perhaps we could actually be talking about something. But the disconnection between the different parts of the country and the U.S. is the size of Europe. And so the body that we're fighting is the size of what the EU would look like if the EU decided to have a single military or sets of military complexes. And so you couple that with the history of the fact, with the history of French street-based movements and resistance to central government, and you just have a really different set of things to even analyze than we have in the U.S. Now that isn't to say that like I don't like good things and riot porn and pretty pictures, but it just says that the disconnect between us analyzing what any sort of street movement. Street-based dissent against central government or state government or local government. I just don't feel like there's like yeah. It's just such a. It just feels to me like a huge gap, and yeah. So I guess that's where I would begin to even answer that question. But if we're going to answer it in a positive sense and say what can we as anarchists learn from the Yellow Vest movement, I think that one of the nice things that has come out of this, even though it's trite and whatever, is this idea that street protest, like it is possible to put fear into the hearts of the leaders who are dominating us. And so it's nice to see that both the gas tax and the minimum wage, and perhaps even, and maybe most importantly, the pension amounts have returned to normal. But ultimately, those messages are all reformist messages. If you engage in politics loudly and vigorously enough on the street, you can get modest reforms.
I feel like there's a version of this conversation that happens every time something like this happens, be it in the US or like Occupy or be it globally. So what do I like? I like the idea that the Yellow Vests pop up in France and then they pop up in Belgium. And perhaps there would be more of them popping up in other places in the world. And on some level, from a, you know, standing back and looking at it all perspective, the message of the people in France and the message of the people in Belgium or anyone's message, whether or not that's consistent, kind of doesn't matter that much. If the phenomenon is seen as an area of concern to the powers that be, then there being more of that, something that can't be controlled, something that's unpredictable. I feel like there's something good, for lack of a better word, in there. I like that. None of it feels new or fresh or any of the very positive blossoming words that are used in the language of the topic of the week. I think the most interesting thing that's happened so far is the cyber gorilla people and their
doxing the cops.
And they're doxing the cops. And really, my response is, why the fuck aren't we doing that all the fucking time? We are so busy doxing
each other
when, you know, half of the people in positions, most of the people in the positions of power in this country are so old, they don't understand how technology works, and they use their private phones to talk to their mistress and their bookie. Why the fuck aren't we putting them on the internet, for the world, on blast, all the time? This feels like the thing that, like, this is what we should be paying attention to.
Why don't we just accept that we're state actors and act like state actors against other state actors?
Yeah, if you're going to embrace this tactic, then use it accordingly. Mm-hmm. Use it appropriately.
Well, because then you actually will face the repercussions. That's why it's not happening in the U.S. context.
Yeah. It will be interesting to see down the road what happens to these people as time goes on. And of course, then there's always, you know, is there something interesting here that now the world is paying attention to that it wasn't paying attention to before?
Well, and that's...
I don't know enough to know whether or not that's true. Yeah.
And this is one of the things about all the hand-wringing about whether or not these people are the right. Because, you know, memetically, what they're basically trying to say is, we're people that drive cars.
I know you didn't mean that to be funny. I don't know why I thought that was so funny.
but what that means is that, like, stop our gas tax... We're the drivers of cars. Or to put it more bluntly, in an American context, these are just NIMBYists, which I think you can safely call right-wing people, i.e. conservatives, i.e. Mm-hmm. don't bother me in mine. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what feels new about this in the political drama, is that usually those people aren't blocking intersections. And you know, in the U.S. context, they mostly just have economic power and don't portray themselves as having political power since the 70s and Proposition 13 and the anti-tax revolts of the Reagan era.
Right. So you don't buy the position that the whole point of the riots in France is that this puts undue burden on poorer, more rural people who have to drive for a living versus centralized, cosmopolitan urbanites who generally have more money who don't have to drive for a living. I've seen this thrown up once, and I don't know enough to know whether or not that's actually legitimate. Yeah, or
I think my read would be that all of the people who do drive every day, whether it's commuting or driving for a living, those are the people who are the ones putting on the yellow vest and hitting the street.
Okay.
And that body of people, like, for better and for worse, of course, they're the ones that are hardest hit.
Right.
But they're also the ones who, you know, in the long view and in the view of the government, are the ones who need to be the ones impacted if we're actually going to change the world to be environmentally capable of going on for more than 20 more years.
I mean, you can argue that the equivalent of this has already occurred in California, right? California's gas costs more than almost anywhere else in the country, and it's primarily because of the taxes that get paid. Mm-hmm. And
it's also probably the richest state in the union.
But it is definitely the richest state in the union. However, you know, people who live in San Francisco and who live in Berkeley drive a lot less than people who say live in the Valley.
Live in Fremont or Vallejo.
Or live in Modesto or live, you know, in the urban farm areas that are the rural farm areas in the middle of nowhere. And arguably the people in San Francisco and Berkeley have a lot more money than the people who live in the Central Valley. Why weren't there riots?
Because our country is very dispersed. In other words, the distance between the quote-unquote countryside and Paris or any of the other major cities in France... Just not that far.
Because France is... Really, France is the size of Texas?
Well, I'm actually not sure. But I think that it probably has as many people as Texas.
Yeah. So, I don't know. The jockeying for... When things like this happen, and this gets mentioned in the topic of the week, and the political position is less than clear, there is frequently, we've seen this so many times in the past. There's a jockeying for...
But I don't think this is ideological. Like, this is as ideological as it is sort of between ideological and practical. In other words,
I think it's way more practical than ideological.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my point.
Okay.
But it seems like now there are people jockeying to apply an ideological context to it, to either endorse it or dismiss it or justify it or celebrate it or I'm not sure. So, yeah. And I guess that just like none of that seems new either. It makes for nice pictures, but I'm not sure, like, if the conversation that the person who's asking, the question is asking is, how do we, basically, how do anarchists, I don't know what, embrace this and affect our politics in the long run, do something interesting with it?
The geography of the two places are similar.
Uh-huh.
The population of France is twice as much as Texas.
Okay. That's a lot of people in a small area.
Mm-hmm.
I guess where I'm going is these things usually end up with Americans. And I guess this is kind of where you started. We don't have enough information. We make the wrong set of assumptions because we make them based on our view of the world and the context that we live in.
Stupid political commentators who have their own agendas. No, I mean, let's be honest here, right?
It's true. It's how what went on in Italy got turned into what we're stuck with now. I guess my thought is if there are good lessons to be taken away from this, if there are interesting anything that we can walk away with it, we're not.
Well. I mean,
we're going to miss it.
But the analysis that has come out that's mostly, been French and from France and translated, like, I feel like the anarchist analysis has been good. It's been solid. There have been a couple articles where I've been like, okay, I feel like my education has improved in this. But by and large, those aren't lessons that I would necessarily say are applicable or relevant to the U.S. context.
Right, I see what you're saying. Like, there's no, yeah, it's not a formula that you can pick up and move across the water.
And more pointedly, like, from an anarchist perspective, how would we pick that up? Like, would we pick it up and say, let's do this in the Bay Area? Let's do this in Texas? Let's do this on the East Coast? None of those different, those three areas are very, very different political atmospheres.
Right.
And what is actually going to happen is that some people are going to buy some safety vests, and the next time that there's some sort of something to be grumpy about that's to the left of the Democratic Party, we're going to see an awful lot of safety vests.
And that's what I mean. So then it just makes you sad.
Thank you very much.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Dim. We thank Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackcart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, see you at anarchistnews.org and or the Anarchist News IRC chat room, linked on Anarchist News.